Okay, well, good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Sabbath greetings to you. Some of you may have been on board last night. I did a Bible study last night, and I do appreciate, again, the Wales and the ministry that they're conducting and bringing people together all around the world, inviting various ones of us to speak. So we do want to thank the Wales for what they're doing. And we had good news last night because I saw Don and Peggy, and I saw also with them Debbie Roth, and so she's recovering nicely, and we're grateful for that. Please continue to pray for her as she recovers from health issues. And well, I'll have more to say about some other matters after I finish this talk. Last night also I had the opportunity to meet somebody from south of Atlanta, she told us that she had originally been living in Minnesota. About 15 years ago or so, I had the opportunity, maybe even longer, I had the opportunity to, Linda and I had the opportunity to visit the Twin Cities. I believe we were in a place called Brooklyn Center, between, you know, in the midst of the Twin Cities there, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we spoke to a group there, and then we had an activity in the evening as well where we interacted with the group there. We were hosted by a very gracious family up there. I was very impressed also with the way the husband and wife interacted, how helpful the husband was to his wife in hosting. And before we flew home, we were able to go, what's it called, the Mall of America? Beautiful place. If you ever get a chance to get up there, Mall of America there in the Twin Cities. And I told a story there that I hope might be interesting to you. It's about a minister who lost his job up in that area. And what happened to him was he gave a sermon in Minneapolis, but he took his sermon from St. Paul. Actually, those Twin Cities are Twin Cities, and they do have a very good and they have a very good relationship with each other. Unlike, in a way, Dallas and Fort Worth. I'm more familiar with the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, as they call it. But Dallas and Fort Worth don't have quite the same love affair, I think, that you might find up in Minneapolis and St. Paul, because they are culturally distinct. Dallas represents, in a sense, the extension of the traditional South in many ways, whereas Fort Worth represents the mid-America breadbasket culture. And even though they're close together, they're frankly on the border of two cultural zones. I bring this out every once in a while when I talk. For those of you who are not from the North American continent, it's a large continent. Canada is a huge country. As one of their prime ministers said, it has too much geography and not enough history, but it's managed to stay together. And then America is a huge country. And so there are really different nations that make up U.S. and Canada. And it overlaps the boundaries. Somebody wrote about that way back around 1980, as you know, in the call of the Nine Nations of North America, Joel Garreau. But a new author, Colin, I'm trying to think of his last name. Is it Harwood? Colin Woodward. Colin Woodward has written a book about 11 nations. And he wrote that just about around the year 2011, I believe. He wrote about 11 nations. So there are people that have noticed, as I said, the latest one seems to be Colin Woodward, and then there's another wonderful book by Richard Hatchett Fisher, I believe is his name, F-I-S-H-E-R, I believe it is. Wonderful book. It's called Albion's Seed. It's a big, heavy history, A-L-B-I-O-N, which, as you know, is a name for Britain, Albion's Seed. And it talks about four great mother cultures and also other cultures, smaller cultures that contributed to the founding of this country and really have been consistent all the way through the history of America. These major cultures that settled different parts of the country and then projected westward and then certain other little pockets of other cultures in there. Very wonderful book, that was recommended to me years ago and I never thought I'd ever find it. Of course, in those days, it was before we could just pick up a handheld device and find whatever we want. But I was wondering if I'd ever find the book. And then in 2007, I was keeping the Festival of Tabernacles in Williamsburg, Virginia, and the book was there. And I remembered, oh, that's the book that was recommended to me. And I bought it there in Williamsburg, Virginia, back in 2007. So that's our background, which in a way is related to what I want to talk about today. You know, America right now is commemorating some major military events. 200 years ago, we had a war within the English-speaking world where the Americans and the British were at war, the War of 1812. But more crucially, in a way, in American history, because of the devastation that it caused and the, let's say the results afterwards, was the American Civil War, the war between the states, which occurred from 1861 to 1865, a century and a half ago. There was a civil war. And today I'm going to talk about a similar war that occurred in ancient Israel, a civil war, a war between tribes. I'm calling this talk, "We Must Remain Grounded in the Truth." We must remain grounded in the truth. You know, if you draw an angle, you can see me now. I have made with my fingers, let's say roughly a 30 degree angle, right? Something along those lines. You'll notice that you make a small deviation and there's a small distance between these two fingers. But if you project these lines outward, they're going to get farther and farther apart. And the farther apart the more you project them, the farther apart they will be. So a small deviation eventually leads to huge issues down the line. We must remain grounded in the truth. What we understand, our beliefs and practices, we need to stay consistent with them. If we begin to deviate and we begin to compromise and water down, after a while it can lead to what we call the slippery slope. And that little distance in that angle is projected outward, gets wider and wider and wider. You know, I remember we had a talk from a fellow, from a minister who was a graduate of Texas A&M, and they like to make up joke books about themselves, Aggie jokes, that they tell on themselves, and I guess somebody makes money from these Aggie jokes. But they had a tradition with a freshman in Texas A&M. They had to be very careful, the freshmen, and very respectful of the upperclassmen. And instead of saying, "I don't know," as I recall, the freshmen had to say this. If you asked them a question they didn't know, they would have to say, "I hesitate to articulate for fear that I might deviate from the path of rectitude." In other words, "I don't know." But that's what we have to be careful about. We don't want to deviate from the path of rectitude. So we must remain really grounded in the scriptures. Because the world around us is losing standards. I don't know what standards are taught in the public school system now. If there are courses in civics where people are taught basic moral behavior, if there are such classes, I don't know if there are. I hope there are. And some standards do need to be maintained, but one wonders how much instruction people are getting in that area. When you begin to see the way the world operates these days. I want to go to John 17:17. Here, when Jesus prayed for us, prayed for his apostles then and the community that had gathered around them, the 120 that became the early church, when he prayed about them and the apostles particularly, he said, "Separate them in what way?" That they would be people who stood for the truth. They would be very well grounded in the scriptures. He said in John 17:17, and this is a prayer that Jesus is praying to his Father, "Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth." And so we are to be set apart by our commitment to God's word. And so depending on the trends, as I've often said, maybe it sounds like a broken record to those of you who hear me often, but I have said often that in any given age, there may be some things about us that people will appreciate and respect. There may be other things about us that they don't like and may really be quite upset about, depending from place to place and from age to age, because we need to consistently reflect the values of Jesus Christ, and from time to time, some of them will be popular and some will not. You know, it depends on the situation. But as I said, I want to talk today about a civil war, which came about because I think of this slippery slope. As people began to deviate from the truth, as they began to water down and compromise, things came worse and worse, And finally, behavior became extreme. You get to the point where you just don't know anymore what's right and wrong. When you don't have defined terms. Basic terms are not understood anymore or are garbled. And so you don't know which end is up, as we say. And I wanted to, talk about the American Civil War and show how it in effect reflects this ancient civil war that we read about in the book of Judges. So let me go back first to the American Civil War. And at the time, 150 years ago, that we had that horrible conflict in the United States, the war between the states, the president of the United States was a person really grounded in the Bible, really very well familiar with the scriptures. And evidently they had a profound impact on him. So much so that he never really found the church to his liking, as far as I understand. Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States, who was a revered figure in America, was very biblically grounded, but I don't think he ever was affiliated with any particular denomination. But in talking about the war that he had, unfortunately had to preside over, in his second inaugural address, he addressed this issue of how the country, through its sins, had finally wound up in this conflict, that he really felt it was a judgment coming upon the country for just not dealing with major sins of the society as a whole. And so society as a whole was suffering as a result. So he talked about the condition of the United States as he took office in 1861, and now it's March of 1864. In those days, the inauguration took place in March. It's March of 1864. The Civil War is going to be going on about another month. And then after winning that war, he's going to be martyred, as we know. So here are some of his comments. He said 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern half part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it. Originally, that was the goal, just restrict it. Eventually, as you know, he abolished it. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. So they really blundered into a horrific conflict, as you see what happened in ancient Israel in some ways a similar way. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before, the conflict itself should cease. So he very cleverly, as you know, in 1863, abolished slavery in those areas of the South occupied by Union troops, and later on there was the 13th Amendment that abolished it nationally. Each looked for an easier triumph, and a result less fundamental and astounding. Now here's something interesting that he said, a very devout man and yet not part of any organized church. Here's what Lincoln said, and I think this applies wherever you're listening, if you're American or not, it's really interesting. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be not judged. So he tells the Northerners, you might self-righteously wonder, how can Southerners pray for help when they were oppressing another race? But, you know, be that as it may, they feel justified. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. So he understood that God has the option of saying yes or no, or, you know, yes for some of what you want, but not for all of what you want. Here's what he goes on to say. The Almighty has his own purposes. Then he quotes from Jesus Christ. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. Of course, he did it in King James language. You know, woe to that man by whom the offense cometh, because he's quoting from the old King James. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him. He's saying, are we saying God's unjust for allowing this to come upon the nation? We had all these years to deal with it, and we didn't deal with it. And so now, you know, it's coming to a head. And then he goes on to say, fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away, which fortunately it did. You know, he said this in March of 1864. The war ended in April, and then shortly afterwards, as you know, he was assassinated, but this prayer was answered. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said, 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Quoting from Psalm 19. Mishpatei Adonai Emet Tzadku Yachdav. Of course, Abraham Lincoln didn't say it in Hebrew. The judgments of the Lord, you know his name was Abraham. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. So he said, we haven't ended this scourge, or this, we are faced with a scourge because of a great national sin, and they were still in the midst of it as he spoke. And so he's saying, you know, we are now paying for the sin, because we have not really eliminated it. He had just recently, in January of 1863, issued a proclamation about it. So he was saying it could be that this war is going to go on as God's judgment on us for not dealing with the problem earlier, and in our own generation not dealing with it as we should have. And so he recognized God's hand in the war, even though he believed God was guiding and directing the war, and that God would give triumph to the Union, and that God indeed would see to it the slaves were freed. Nevertheless, God allowed a great deal of trouble as well. So it was, in other words, the you might say justice came about, but also a price had to be paid. And Lincoln saw God's hand in all of that. And you can see other statements that he made regarding his belief in divine providence. And what, I remember an earlier thing he said. I see the storm coming. I know his hand is in it. And he said something along the line, if he has a place for me, I believe I am ready. Something along those lines. So he wrote that maybe before he began serving as president. You know, I see this storm coming. I know his hand is in it. If there's a place for me, and I believe there is, I believe I am ready. Of course, you know, it was way beyond his ability or anybody's ability to handle, but he did have God's help, I believe. And then he finishes this part of the address with a belief in reconciliation once the war is over, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to achieve and cherish a lasting peace among ourselves and with the world. And America, of course, did reunite and has been reunited up until now. To do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with the world and all nations. And I'll leave it there. And it's very interesting because the same thing happened in ancient Israel, a kind of a parallel situation. The nation had gotten involved with perverse behavior. They had begun to compromise with the truth and water it down and mix it up. And it finally came to a head with a very extreme action, which actually provoked a conflict among the tribes. And we find it in the book of Judges. Now, the book of Judges, in the 17th chapter and in the 6th verse, it tells us that this was a time when people were just basically doing their own thing. It had come to the point, Joshua was dead, and evidently the elders who had served with Joshua were dead. There was one person still alive, Phinehas, the high priest, the grandson of Aaron, who evidently lived a long time, was still alive, but most of the generation that had been with Joshua had died out, and the Israelites were now beginning to deviate from their commitment to the covenant. And part of it had to do with the fact that they had peoples around them that they were supposed to have gotten rid of, or, you know, driven out, that remained there. Those peoples were influencing them in a negative way. Anyway, in Judges 17:6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So there wasn't really a central governing authority that could enforce the old covenant. And so it was an anarchic kind of time, and people did what was right in their own eyes. And it's incredible what you can wind up thinking is right when you have your own eyes to judge by. It's incredible how scriptures can be misapplied or perverted, or of course I'm often ignored, or some verses quoted and others left alone. You know how it goes, and you decide what you choose to believe and what you don't, and it gets really to an extreme. It can and often does, given time, and that's what happened in the book of Judges. And it happened quite early in the period. It wasn't long at all before really bizarre behavior began to occur as people deviated. And if you read the New Testament, you'll find it wasn't long before the New Testament church began to deviate in very dramatic ways. Before the New Testament was even finished, there were people pleading to get back on track. Before the New Testament was even finished, you had corruption setting in. It can happen that fast. So I want to go to Judges, the 19th chapter. And, that's how the book ends, by the way. Let's go to the end of the book. After all this material, it tells you, you're wondering how this happened. How could things get so bad? And it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, if people do what's right in their own eyes, that's the kind of thing that happens. You read about what Proverbs tells us. You have to be grounded in the Bible, or at least have some basic standards of morality that people can agree, by consensus agree upon. Not everybody doing what's right in his own eyes. Anyway, let's go to Judges 19, and I'm going to just summarize this account because it's very graphic. There's a lot of detail, and I believe the detail is here to show you that this is not some parable, that this is an actual historical account. So there's a lot of detail given, I think, to emphasize that. They say that truth is stranger than fiction. And when we read the story now, it's not unlike things we read about, unfortunately, in the news every day. That's what's so sad about it. It's very much a reflection of our modern world. The world we live in now, in a way, is very much like the world of the Judges, where people are doing what's right in their own eyes. We are living in a time of moral decay and breakdown of just basic consensus of what the virtues are, and the society is paying a penalty for that. And frankly, I get kind of depressed just watching the news day by day. I watch it. I'm interested in it. But it's often very depressing as I see just the kind of values or lack of values that I see reflected in much of what is going on. I'm sure you all feel, many of you feel the same way. And we can be influenced, if we're not careful, to go with the flow rather than to stand up against it. As I said, we need to be very much committed to our beliefs and practices. And as I began this talk, I entitled this talk, "We Must Remain Firm, We Must Remain Grounded in the Truth." That's what I said. We must remain grounded in the truth, right? Okay. So let's go to Judges 19. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel, see, that's brought up again, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So it wasn't a wife, but it was a concubine. So her status was as a female servant, but who also, in effect, lived with a person as a wife, but didn't have the same standing as a wife would have legally. So she was a wife, but yet not in the full sense. She was a servant with whom he lived as husband and wife. And as I said, her status was not equal to that of a wife, but they did live together. And then evidently she was a loose woman, and so right away you see issues that come up because she was not one that kept her commitment to him, but they finally reconciled, to make a long story short. So now they're back together again, and he had gone back to Judah to get her, and now they were going back up to the north where he lived. So that's the context here. And so let's go to 11, verse 11 of this chapter. They went near Jebus, which, as you know, eventually became Jerusalem. So let me say again, this is very early in the period of the Judges. It's at the end of the book, but it happened very early in the history of the Judges. And it just shows how soon things began to deteriorate because people were not keeping their commitment. As I said, you begin to deviate a little, then it gets greater and greater and greater, and after a while, you know, things really get out of hand. Anyway, verse 11. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come, please, and let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." At that time, it was a Canaanite city. But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah." So he said, "We don't want to go to these people. These are Canaanites," and perhaps he was afraid of how he would be treated. Let's go to our own kind, right? Let's go to another tribe of Israel, Benjamin. Let's go there. Seems logical. So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw..." Did I say this? Yes. So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of the of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah." By the way, if it's not light enough, there's another light that could be a couple of lights that could be turned on. How am I coming across? I'm coming across fine. Okay. Those of you who are watching me, it's not like I'm in the dark. Good. All right. Reminds me, there was a radio program of a guy who used to call himself the Shadow. And I don't know, somehow he would come into a room and people would know he was there. I don't know how he did it. I forget. I mean, I saw some of those episodes when I was very small because he eventually made movie serials where every week there'd be a chapter. You know, some of you who are very old would remember that, you'd go to the movies and there'd be these episodes, and then, you know, they'd leave you hanging, and then you'd come back the next week, see a couple of movies, and see the next episode. And it was a guy called The Shadow. Well, hopefully, I'm more than a shadow. You're actually seeing me out there. All right, let's go on. Verse 14. And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go into lodge in Gibeah, and when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into the house to spend the night. Now, what does this remind you of? I would think, as you may not know this chapter of Judges all that well. I hope you do, but if you don't, you know Genesis better, perhaps, and you know what happened with the angels that people, you know, they didn't know they were angels, they thought they were people that went to visit Lot, you know, in Sodom. And the same thing happened there. You know, they had no place to stay. Finally, Lot said, "No, stay with me," you know. So they had said, "Let's go to our own kind." And their own kind didn't want to take them in. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" Verse 18. So he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem to Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I am going to the house of the Eternal." So he's going north up to where Shiloh is, where the house of the Eternal is. "But there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." So he said, "You don't have to, you know, bring your own provision. I'll have you in my place and I'll take care of you." Very finally, one hospitable person. But he was evidently not a local. Or at least not from there originally, right? So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkey. And they washed their feet and ate and drank. And then we have the same behavior as we find in Sodom. And these were Benjamites, these were Israelites, these were people who were not so far removed from the generation that had been at Sinai, that had come through the wilderness and had conquered the land. You know, this would have been not so long ago historically that those things would have happened. And yet, as I said, it wasn't long before those memories faded. And people began doing their own thing. So I'm in verse 22 now. And as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, I believe that the term in Hebrew literally is sons of Belial, you know, people of, you know, worthless people, sons of Belial, you know, what we call biblical SOBs, sons of Belial. Perverted men surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally. Same thing as what happened in Sodom. And of course, once, you know, and just like what happened in Sodom, you know, Lot didn't want that to happen, and he even offered his daughters. But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please, but to this man do not do such a vile thing. So, obviously, there's a certain approach that, you know, this is not something that I would think culturally we would identify with, to act in that way. But that was his solution to the problem, if you want to call that a solution. But the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. So, you know, because they insisted and his life was evidently in danger, he brought out his concubine and felt like, okay, I'll give the concubine to them and maybe that'll be enough. And evidently it was, but what a horrible thing. And, you know, as I said, you read about this and it's horrible, but it's here in the Bible for us to read about. And as I said, it's very much like things you read about in the news, unfortunately, today. Anyway, so I'm in verse 25, but the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night and until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. But by that time, she was near death. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where his master was till it was light. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up and let us be going. I think that kind of shows his attitude towards her, the way this is put. It's not like he was all worried about what had happened to her and you know, very solicitous for her welfare. It's basically the idea, well, you know, let's move on now. You know, it's very sad. The attitude that he had toward her. It seems to be implied by the way this is worded. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. So now he saw that she had died. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine, divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. So he felt this was a great outrage, a horrific thing, and he had evidence of it. And so he sent this evidence all over. And this was a way of arousing people to deal with it. This city must be disciplined. A city that could have so many people of that mentality, and nobody stopped them, you know, that they would do such a thing, needed, the discipline was needed. And it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done. Well, that's at least to their credit, and it's the first time anything like that bad had happened. But it happened. And so it was that all who saw it said, no deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer and speak up. So they all came together, leaders of the various tribes. So all that, now I'm in Judges 20. So now what happens as a result? We have this horrific behavior in Gibeah, in Benjamin. We find these people acting in that way, and we find, this outrage occurring, this murder, in effect, that occurs, sexual abuse, which leads to murder. And now and plus the violation, of course, of hospitality, not helping somebody who needs a place to stay and so forth, which is minor compared to what else they did, but all of that, you know, the whole package of that kind of behavior. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Eternal at Mizpah, and the leaders of the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now, it seems that what they were going to do was handle this violently, was, you know, if necessary, go to war against this city. Now, it's interesting that they appeared before the Eternal, you know, as his people, but it doesn't talk about seeking his guidance in the matter at this point. They're gathering together as his people, but we don't see any formal seeking of his direction in the matter. They seem to be right away deciding, here's what we're going to do. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. Then the children of Israel said, "Tell us, how did the wicked deed happen?" Okay, so now the Levites, you know, discussing with them what happened, I'll just skip over that. I talked about that, and let's go on to verse 8. All right. So all the people arose as one man, saying, "None of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000, to make provisions for the people that when they come to Gibeah in Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." Now, once again, they decide on this course of action, and it doesn't seem that they've actually gone to God and formally asked his guidance in the matter. They've just made this decision. So we're going to have here a civil war. Now, I talked about the fact that the United States went through this kind of an experience. And, of course, the British went through this kind of an experience several times in their history until, frankly, they got rid of the troublemakers. You know, while the Americans were living in England, we had the War of the Roses, House of Lancaster versus the House of York. Then we had the Puritans versus the Cavaliers. Finally, the troublemakers left, came over here, and so there had been no civil wars in England since that happened, but we've had quite a civil war here. Anyway, in verse 11, "So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, 'What is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel.' But the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel." Well, this does seem to be a reasonable request. You know, let the guilty ones be turned over to justice. But it's interesting that the Benjamites seem to not consider, this is a horrible stain on our tribe. How could any of our people do this? Isn't this horrible? And yes, we should punish them and discipline them and so that our tribe would not do anything like this, and so that we would reconcile with the other tribes. Instead, what they did is what we call in English metaphor, circle the wagons and defend your fellow Benjamite. You know, in other words, like as I've been telling people nowadays, this is what I've been seeing out in the world. The ideas I've made in my mind, don't confuse me with the facts. You know, they're Benjamites, I'm Benjamite, and I'm going to stick up for them no matter what. Anyway, so let's go on. "Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men." And it talks about people who were left-handed, which evidently was a military asset in those days. You could have right-handed and left-handed people. And the Benjamites had this proclivity of being left-handed, as you read about in the Bible and elsewhere. "Among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. Now beside Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war." So again, if you're American, it looks so much like, unfortunately, our own Civil War. You know, here in Orlando, just to show you the impact of the Civil War on American culture, on United States culture, because I know some of you are listening in other parts of the world, but the Civil War has had a big impact on American culture, especially where I live. I live in the South, frankly. And in the South, the Civil War is much more of a factor in people's thinking than it is in the North, frankly. But here, for example, in Orlando, just this week, there's an exhibit taking place of a very famous movie, Gone with the Wind. which is based on a novel about the Civil War and what happened to the South, the, you know, leading up to it and afterwards. Now, it focuses, of course, on one family and I guess on one woman. I haven't read the novel, but I've seen the movie. But Gone with the Wind, that famous novel about the, you know, the fall of the South, came out in 1939, and most everybody's heard of it. Well, here in Orlando, is this week, there's an exhibit on that movie taking place, right, even as I speak. And it shows you the cultural impact of the Civil War, particularly in this part of the country, as I'm saying. Well, here was a very similar situation. Benjamin was outnumbered, but they felt that they were very talented militarily. And even though the, you know, you could say, if you want to, like the Union had the manpower, but you could say the South had maybe the military talent. Very much like our own Civil War a century and a half ago here. But now, finally, they ask God about the situation, you know. And what did they ask him? Not what should we do, but who should go up first? So evidently God's saying, okay, this is how you're going to solve it. All right, I'll let you solve it in this way. You know, God has allowed history to work out in certain ways, and you might say in messy ways. He had his will, he had his plan, but he's let people, you know, have a certain amount of leeway in how we get from point A to point B. I'll give you, for example, the American Revolution. Did it have to be violent, the way it occurred? Maybe there would have been some other way that we might have parted company with the British Empire in a more peaceful way at some stage in history. But things came to a head and it came out in a very violent, messy way. You know, and that's the way human history works. God has his plan, God has his prophecies, and he guides and directs history, but he gives people a leeway and free will, and so we tend to get from point A to point B, but in a messy way, you know, to use an understatement. So God is telling them, all right, I am going to use you to punish Benjamin, but I'm also going to at the same time punish you because you're also worthy of punishment. You haven't been exactly saints yourself. So he allowed them to go to war, as Lincoln talked about. That's why I read Lincoln's material earlier, because Lincoln understood that the country as a whole was being punished. And God would work it out, and the Union would be preserved, and slavery would end, and he had faith that that would happen. But he also believed that God was going to allow a good deal of pain in the process to punish the nation, and he saw that as God's justice, as I read from, you know, as you heard me read, as Lincoln quoted from the Bible, New Testament and Old Testament. So here we have the same situation. God is allowing this battle to occur. Things are going to work out where people will be punished for their sins. And so they said to him, who's going to go first? Well, as you might expect, Judah goes first. They tend to be the ones who lead in military activity. Judges 20:18. Then the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? And the Eternal said, Judah. And so Judah led, but Benjamin won this first encounter. Just like what happened in the American Civil War, the slaveholding Southerners did fairly well at first, particularly in the East. And so many Northerners almost lost heart in those early goings, you know, and it took a lot to keep the war going. Finally, it decisively turned the other way. But it's very much like the American Civil War. Benjamin won the first encounter. And, let's go to verse 23. Then the children of Israel went up and wept before the Eternal until evening and asked counsel of the Eternal, saying, shall I again, I'm in verse 23, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? This is a brother's war, just as the, you know, American Civil War of a later time. Some of you perhaps, I'm in Orlando, and so I'm very, you know, Disneyfied. Some of you may remember Disney has a beautiful section, two brothers on their way, I'm almost in tears. Two brothers on their way, one wore blue and one wore gray. And that was the situation here. You know, these are Israelites. These are fellow tribes. But a horrible thing had happened. And one tribe would not punish the perpetrators. Rather, they gathered together and defended these people who really had no defense. They were criminals, obviously. But their idea was, well, we're Benjamites, and, you know, we're not going to let them, you know, punish our people, whatever the attitude was there. And so, you know, they say, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? And the Eternal said, go up against them. Go up against him, you know, meaning Benjamin. So it happened again. And they lost again. So this time they bring Phinehas in, the great high priest, the zealous defender of the faith. You know, you go back to Numbers 25, and he's still alive. He's one of the few probably still alive from the time of Joshua. They go to Phinehas. I'm in verse 27 now. And you may remember that in the Civil War, it wasn't until really 1864 that really the tide turned, particularly in the eastern part of the country. Things went relatively well in the west, but in the east, things really decisively turned around in 1864. You know, 150 years ago this year is when things really began to happen, particularly later in that year. And then into 1865, of course, it was pretty much a done deal. And so after two defeats, we finally have now the turnaround here. Because obviously Israel had the manpower to defeat the Benjamites, but it's also a matter of what God's going to allow. You could have said the same thing about the American Civil War. Why did it go on so long? Why didn't the North win earlier? Why was such a price paid? Well, Lincoln believed it was divine providence, that God was punishing the nation. And so it would seem here. God told them that they could go to war, And he said, let Judah go first, but at the same time, he allowed them to suffer defeats. And as I said, a judgment was coming upon both Benjamin and the other tribes. So now we go to verse 27. So the children of Israel inquired of the Eternal. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. So evidently, the Ark had been brought there, and Phinehas was there. Verse 28, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Eternal said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. And then you can read about the strategy employed. So now, finally, they get their wits about them. This is like, you know, if you can, the analogy again with the American Civil War, this is where Lincoln finds General Grant, and Grant has Sherman, and between Grant and Sherman, they make pretty, you know, quick work of the South, and that's why we had the burning of Atlanta that the movie Gone with the Wind talked about, you know, to segue back into this exhibit that's going on here in Orlando. And it's horrible, the whole thing is horrible to talk about, but yet it is now part of American folklore, and it's part of the Bible. Something similar is in the Bible here. You know, so they finally get a good strategy put together, effective tactics put together, and decisively defeat Benjamin. So you can keep on reading, and Benjamin is routed, as you know, you might have expected to finally happen. So Benjamin is almost exterminated. And now you're faced with what happens after. And, you know, what happens now? We've almost devastated Benjamin. They're a tribe of Israel. They're our brethren. They're entitled to an heritage in this promised land. What's going to happen now? Well, once again, we find that they had decided to do what was right in their own eyes. You see that all through the book of Judges. Sometimes people think they're being very religious, and they, you know, and we kind of make up our own rules and think that we're being very righteous. What can I tell you? You know, one thing that comes to mind, being Jewish, is the fact that it says, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. All right? That's a rather perverse thing to do, wouldn't it be? To cook a kid in its mother's milk? But evidently it was a pagan practice, a ritual in those days. There's archaeological evidence to show that. And so three times in the Bible it says, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Well, you'd be amazed if you knew, the Jewish religion about what was done with that principle. About not mixing meat products with milk products and just get so complicated. You have to have a separate dish, separate set of dishes for your dairy products, set of dishes for your meat products. You know, some of you live in Southern California. Maybe you can still visit the Queen Mary. Doobie and Rebecca were married on the Queen Mary. I did the ceremony. We were not, of course, out to sea. You know, we were in Long Beach. You know, you can go to Long Beach and see the Queen Mary. You know what you'll see? You'll see a coffee cup. And it says meat coffee. Then you'll see a coffee cup that says dairy coffee. What? Meat coffee? Well, that's the coffee you had with meat, which means you couldn't put milk in that cup. You couldn't put cream in that cup. Now, there are substitutes you could put in, something that, you know, that seems like my cream or milk, but not real milk or cream. So, because evidently the Queen Mary did have a set of kosher dishes there. And El Al has that now. El Al Airline has two kitchens. Why am I bringing that up? Now, I'm not trying to pick on anybody in particular. I could pick on the Southern Baptists as well, who have decided that it's some great sin to drink alcohol at all. You know, to drink any alcohol is a sin in their mind. They can eat plenty of ham and pork and shrimp and all the rest of it, but not to drink any alcohol. You know, so they've decided they're on their own dietary laws, you could say. Again, I don't want to pick on the Southern Baptists. I live in this part of the country. You know, but I'm just bringing out, people have their own kind of zeal, their own, you know, rules and regulations. And that's what these people did. Now, the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. Why did they do that? Wasn't necessary to do that. But now they felt like they had to keep the oath. Then the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voice and wept bitterly and said, O eternal God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? Well, because you shut off your mouth and made that vow. Well, you couldn't give your daughters to the Benjamites. Why'd you do that? Well, anyway, there are various ways they solved the problem. And for lack of time, I won't go into everything they did. You can read about what they did, and it's really terrifying to read. But let's look at the final step. There was step one and step two. I'll talk about step two because it's more, in a way, it's less violent in one sense. It's fairly violent, but less violent, and in a way somewhat romantic. It reminds you of a movie that some of you may have seen called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. You know, so let's look at how finally they solved the problem of those Benjamites who still didn't have wives. So let's go to verse 17 of this chapter. And as I said, I'm cutting out some rather graphic material that you can read. You got plenty of time. The Sabbath is young in most places where I'm speaking. Or if it's not, you know, it's Saturday night, the beginning of the week. You can begin the week with Bible study and you can read what I have left out. Verse 17, and they said there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. Now, one reason I'm reading this is because it's somewhat seasonal. It may be that the events I'm going to read about took place on the full moon of the fifth month, which was a week ago. It was on a Monday, it was, I guess the Monday before last was the full moon. We're now in the 20th. Was it this Monday? Yeah, I guess it was Monday of this week, right? Because we're in the 20th now of the fifth month, so the full moon was Monday. And that's the lover's holiday now in Israel. It's a time when in ancient times, in biblical days, on the full moon of the fifth month, it was the beginning of the grape harvest, and the eligible women would come out and dance, and the men could make their choice in a nice way. You know, the men, women would come out and dance for the men, and the men would make their choice. Again, it reminds me of another movie I saw where Moses is seeing the daughters of Jethro dance, and he's supposed to choose a wife. That would happen on a full moon of the fifth month in ancient times. And it may be what's going to go on here. This may have been happening at that time. Just speculation, all right? Speculation. Anyway, let's go to verse 18. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin. Then they said, in fact, here's the solution for what's left of the single men of Benjamin. How are they going to get wives? In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Eternal in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. And so the author here is letting us know the location so we get a sense of it. And I think there may be one reason for telling us that is so that chances are the women in that area were closely related to Benjamin. They were descendants of Joseph. Joseph was Benjamin's brother. So these Benjamite men were marrying Josephite women. And so they were, in a sense, marrying within their general gene pool, you could say. They were descendants of Rachel. You understand what I'm telling you? So the region of the Josephites, probably most of the women that the Benjamites wound up marrying would have been closely related because they would have been descendants of Joseph. So that may be one reason for the detail here. Anyway, now I go to verse 20. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh. Then go to the land of Benjamin. Well, this is quite a way to choose a wife. I mean, it's parodied in the movie Seven Wives for Seven Brothers. They're supposedly copying the so-called rapists of the Sabine women. That there's some work of art or poem, whatever it is, is read about. In fact, by the way, there's a custom in America and maybe in other countries for a man to carry his wife into their home. He'd carry her over the threshold. That custom comes from the, as far as I understand, the so-called rape of the Sabine women. That's where I think that custom comes from. Don't feel guilty if you've done it. I don't mean that. I'm not trying to make you feel bad if you did it that way. But anyway, so here they, you know, grab a woman and take her away and you can marry her, and that's how they solve the problem. Now, is that the ideal way for people to mate? Of course not. For to find your spouse, you hide in the bushes and grab her as she dances? No. But that's the whole tenor of this book. People were doing all kinds of things. You know, you're getting in one mess after another, so you have to solve one mess by getting into another mess. You know, it all finally settled down. You know, the Benjamites had their women, and things settled down, and the tribe survived, and Benjamin, multiplied over time, so you had all the tribes of Israel. But, you know, what a messy way to do it. And that's what I'm saying. Things work out, but not in an ideal way. Anyway, so let's go to verse 21. And watch, and when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin. Then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. You didn't violate the oath. They took them. You didn't give your daughter to the guy. The guy took her. So you didn't violate your oath. So peace. Let it be. So that Benjamin survives. So that all the Benjamite males have women. Then the children of Benjamin did so, verse 23, and took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. So there was peace, and there was a nation reconciled tribe to tribe. And of course, later on, a Benjamite became the first king of Israel, uniting the kingdom. Saul was a Benjamite. So Benjamin had its opportunity, and actually the Holy Temple, Mount Moriah, is in Benjamite territory. Most of Jerusalem is Judah, but the Temple Mount is actually the territory of Benjamin. So everything worked out, but, you know, after a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, you could say everything did work out. And why did it have to work out in this unseemly way, this unusual way? Because it's summarized at the end. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So when you read the book of Judges, you see bizarre developments like this, where people are trying to do the right thing, but it comes out, you know, so messy. And it has to do with the fact that Israel did not faithfully, consistently, steadfastly keep its commitment to the covenant. They knew better, but over time they began to water down, compromise, copy what was around them, and over time begin to make their own rules and own approaches to things, and began to deviate more and more from the truth. They did not remain firmly grounded in the truth, and as I said, it leads to a slippery slope. It leads to extreme behavior. And what I'm seeing, unfortunately, in modern society, is I see, at least in the country that I'm familiar with, my own country, the United States, I see that we have, it seems to me, a greater and greater tendency not to have any really fixed standards for very basic institutions and basic concepts of right and wrong. It seems to me that we're just shades of gray. You know, it reminds me of a song that a group in the 60s used to sing, the Monkees. How does that go? Only shades of gray? Isn't that, yeah. And they were saying that in the 60s. I think it's even more so now that for many people in this country, when we talk about standards, virtues, right and wrong, it's shades of gray. And we in God's church need to buck this trend. We need to really understand what's in the Bible. We need to review what's here, because you'd be surprised. If I challenged you on certain basic information in the Bible, would you know it? I mean, do you know the Ten Commandments? Do you know the fruits of the Holy Spirit? Do you know the major characters of the stories in the Bible? go back and review. And you'll find that when you read these accounts, there's details you'll see that you don't remember. Oh, I don't remember that part of the story. Or maybe insights will come to you that you didn't have before. When you review parts of the Bible that you haven't reviewed in a long time, some of you maybe have not read this part of the Bible for a while that I read today. Go back, if you go back over it, you'll learn a lot. So I want to conclude by going to 1 Timothy. Paul writing to Timothy, talking about the role of the church, because I'm speaking to you today as a minister of God's church. And I believe that it's my responsibility to play a part in preserving the truth, preserving and spreading the truth. And as I said in the beginning of this talk, we are set apart, John 17:17, by our commitment to the Word of God, God's truth. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 14. Paul writes to Timothy, "These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I am delayed," this is in 1 Timothy 3:15, "so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." So let's, as people of God, as members of the church of God, remain grounded in the truth. Well, I thank you very much for your interest in this ministry. Those of you who perhaps saw the Bible study last night on the book of Habakkuk, or those of you who went through this material with me today, or will do it later if you're seeing a recording of this, I want to thank you again for your prayers on behalf of people we've mentioned who need prayers. John Halford is recovering from his problems, but he still needs continued prayers. He's not totally out of the woods. I mentioned Debbie Roth, I believe, in the beginning of this talk. She's doing better, and she continues to need your prayers. I would also like to give you the good news that Betty Martin, my sister-in-law, about whom you've been praying, has been able, as far as we know, to attend services today there in Dallas. So that's, you know, really wonderful to know that. Just as we were excited to see Debbie Roth at the Bible study last night there in Hartford, Wisconsin, we're excited to hear of Betty, that she's able to attend there in the Dallas area. And finally, I would like to mention an old friend of mine. His wife died recently, and I talked about that. But Harry Curley has his own health issues now, and with the loss of his wife, he now is facing life without her, but he has health issues. And so please pray also for Harry Curley and his recovery. And those of you who live in his area in Southern California, a message has gone out from Cletus Decker concerning help you can be to him at this time. So if any of you are in Southern California, let me remind you of what Cletus Decker is talking about in terms of certain ways that you can be of help. I'd like to once again remind everybody that very soon will be the autumn festival season, and that we're hosting the festivals down here: the Festival of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the Festival of Tabernacles, the Eighth Day. We hear that there's a significant contingent coming down from Wisconsin. We're really excited to meet you. And we know that there are some coming from Southern California. We're excited to see them again. So if any of you are still making plans for the fall festival season, you know, keep in mind that we'll be hosting the fall festivals here. And we hope in the spring festival season to be out in Southern California among those of you out there who, many of you are listening at this moment in Southern California. We hope to be there at the spring festival season. We have a Facebook page. If you're interested in participating in that, if you're interested in emailing, I've gotten some interesting questions that way that I've answered recently. And so however you want to communicate, we're certainly grateful for that. And so as the Sabbath begins to wane, and as we look forward to the week ahead, all the best to you and yours.